Hello, everyone. This is Alan Davidson. I am the founder of ThroughYourBody.com and the author of Body Brilliance, Mastering Your Five Vital Intelligences. Tonight, I'm hosting on this teleclass a pillar of consciousness and transformation in our world, Dr. Stan Groff. Hello, Dr. Groff, and welcome to the call.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. I had heard about you and holotropic breathing when I was a massage student many years ago, but I finally had the opportunity to experience your work at a six-day Vipassana retreat that I did with Matt Cornfield and several other Vipassana teachers. And one afternoon, he led us in a breathing exercise that you had shared with him and taught him. And at the end of 70 men breathing very intensely, he played this exquisite piece of Russian Orthodox chanting. Mm-hmm. And I had the experience of just leaving my body and the most exquisite sense of peace. So that really whetted my thirst for your whole body of work and holotropic breath work.
You know,
so thank you very much.
Jack and I are old friends, and we have been actually doing joint retreat. We combine Vipassana meditation with the breathwork. It's a very, very powerful combination.
Yes, yes. Having quieted the mind and sitting for several days and then doing the intensity of the breathwork really worked beautifully together. But I want to say, Stan, there are quite a few people who signed up for the call, and some of them are students of yours and are very familiar with who you are and your body of work, and there are people who are absolutely brand new to Stan Groff and holotropic breathwork. So in the next hour, I want to give everybody a taste of who you are and how we can all benefit from using your pioneering work in the world. So I'm going to ask some basic questions to start with, and then we'll get into some really juicy questions.
Okay.
So how do you define consciousness?
You know, I was trained as a medical doctor and then as a psychiatrist, and there is like a basic assumption that consciousness is something that can be explained as a product of the neurophysiological processes in the brain. Nobody has ever really shown how something like that could possibly happen, that, you know, matter would suddenly become conscious of itself. But this is like the basic metaphysical assumption that I was brought up with. And then all these years of psychedelic research and then the work with breath work and working with people who experience spontaneous episodes of non-ordinary states, what we call spiritual emergencies, just showed me that this is absolutely untenable. For me, consciousness now is something that cannot be further reduced to anything else. It's sort of fundamental property of existence. It's something very basic. It's the ultimate mystery. You know, the way it's described in some of the Eastern, great Eastern spiritual philosophies.
So, I mean, you make an important distinction between ordinary states of consciousness and then non-ordinary states of consciousness. So please say a little bit more about that.
You know, actually, I almost don't agree with the distinction anymore. We have a son-in-law who comes from the Ojibwe tradition, Native American tradition, and so I have been having these wonderful, wonderful discussions with his mother. She told me, you know, Stan, I don't know why you call these states non-ordinary. For my people, they're just part of the spectrum of experiences that human beings can have, you know. So, and I had to agree with her. But basically, the ordinary state of consciousness is something in which we experience ourselves as a Newtonian object, as a body ego, or what Alan Watts called skin encapsulated ego, and we experience ourselves as existing in a world that has Newtonian characteristics, which means space is three-dimensional, time is linear, everything seems to be linked with chains of cause and effect, everything seems to be deterministic and so on. Now, in these non-ordinary states, or I should say, actually more specifically, holotropic states, and I will explain it in a minute. So in these states, you know, suddenly all these characteristics can be transcended. For example, we can have the sense that our body dissolves and we become somebody else, some other person, some other life form. We can even become sort of mythological beings. We can find ourselves in another century, in another country, sometimes with a sense of personal remembering. Then people talk about past life experiences and so on. Also, in the ordinary state of consciousness, we can be only in one place at a time. If you are in a holotropic state, in a non-ordinary state, you can be in several places at the same time. So you can be, let's say, in Houston doing the breath work, and suddenly, before you know, you are in the birth canal at the time when you were being born. And then it can take you to Renaissance France, or samurai Japan. So you can be in several places, either alternately or even at the same time. And also at several points of time, you can change your coordinates and so on. So those are, you know, those are quite significantly different, but at the same time there's a kind of a pretty smooth transition from what we call ordinary, what we call non-ordinary. But those, you know, the two extremes can certainly be clearly defined from each other. Now, I mentioned that term holotropic. You know, traditional psychiatry actually is using a different term, and that's altered states, which is something that I really dislike because it always makes me think about veterinary medicine. You get your pet altered, you know, so it's pejorative for me. It suggests that there is a correct way of experiencing yourself, and that in these altered states, that it's somehow impaired, that it's a distorted way of experiencing yourself, which is not what the mystics think. When you have a state like that, you have the feeling that you're actually getting some important missing part that you need to really understand existence, not that your perception of existence is distorted. So those of us who have done a lot of work with consciousness, we prefer the term non-ordinary. You know, that Jane, the mother of our son-in-law, objected against. But even that is very, very broad. You can experience many non-ordinary states which are not really very interesting. They might be clinically important, but they are not very interesting. You can get very drunk and you'll be in a non-ordinary state. Or you can have a typhoid fever and hallucinate and so on. So I'm interested in a subgroup of non-ordinary states which have very special properties. They are potentially healing. They're potentially transformative, even evolutionary. And I was just astounded that current psychiatry does not have a name for these states. We don't have a category, a mystical state, a spiritual state, and so on. People get diagnoses for these kinds of experiences and are put on tranquilizers. So since I saw that we don't have a name, I decided to coin one myself, and I call them holotropic. This particular subcategory, this is the states that the shamans experience as part of their initiatory crisis, or that they use in the work with their clients, the kind of states that the initiates experience in rites of passage of native cultures, or what the initiates experience in the ancient mysteries of death and rebirth, what the yogis, the Christian mystics, the Taoists, the Kabbalists are experiencing. These are not pathological states. If anything, these are supernormal states. And that term, which I coined for them, holotropic, means moving toward wholeness. So I believe that you know, ultimately, our identity is with the cosmic creative principle, the way it's found in the Eastern spiritual philosophies, that our identity is not that of the body ego, but stretches from the totality of creative energy and the body ego. And these holotropic states can take us in the direction of this, our cosmic identity, sometimes in small steps, sometimes in large jumps. So this is where the term holotropic comes from, and also, of course, holotropic breathwork, which is a method that can induce these holotropic states.
So just to make sure I understood what you said, there's the ordinary state of going through our lives, our ego states of living and working and being in a body, the striving of the ego, the seeking of the ego, and then there are these non-ordinary states, some of which, you know, whether you're drunk or intoxicated or you've got a high fever, but you're very particularly interested in a subgroup of those non-ordinary states, which you call holos or holotropic.
Yes, those that I described.
Right.
I believe they are in a very special category, and they are supernormal rather than abnormal or subnormal.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, do we have a kind of intelligence that guides us on this journey towards wholeness and healing that is accessed through psychotropic or hallucinogenic drugs or through the breath work?
That's an excellent question, actually. And it's essential for understanding the holotropic breath work. You know, we have many different schools of psychotherapy, and they don't agree about some of the most fundamental things, like what are the basic motivating forces in the psyche? Why do symptoms develop? What do symptoms mean? And they also disagree as to the therapeutic technique. You know, how should you work with people to help them if they have emotional or psychosomatic problems? And so it's almost, if you have a problem, you can flip a coin and choose a school, and each gives you a different different explanation for what's wrong with you, and also a different method that's supposed to be the method of choice for your kind of a problem. And there's this phenomenal lack of agreement. So it's pretty arbitrary, you know, what therapists will be doing with you. Whereas when we work with holotropic states, we found out that once you get into that state, it mobilizes a kind of inner healing intelligence that would guide you. Jung talked about this, Carl Gustav Jung, the Swiss psychiatrist, talked about it as the self with a capital S. So the alternative strategy, rather than trying to understand the psyche of another person, figure out what goes wrong, and then come up with some kind of technique to fix them, you basically put them into a special state of mind which mobilizes this inner healing intelligence, and then automatically the content in the psyche that have strong emotional charge and for this reason are very relevant, very important for you, start automatically surfacing. And as facilitators, we are not running the process. We are just trying to intelligently support it, cooperate with it. So it's more like a midwifery, you know. If you are trying to give birth to a baby, you don't go there with a forceps and try to figure out how to get it out. The process already has an intelligence of its own. So you step back and let it unfold, and only when something gets stuck, you might step in and help it a little. But once it's in motion, then again, you let the woman rely on their own inner biological intelligence. So Jung talked about this as the individuation process, that there is a sort of a higher intelligent within us that has a certain kind of a plan for us that's going to guide us. So we talk about the inner healer here. So we are not doing anything to people in this holotropic breathwork. We just create a very supportive environment. We give them a method to go into a holotropic state, which is faster breathing, you know, powerful, evocative music, much of which comes from spiritual traditions or from from native traditions, and they breathe, and then under the best of circumstances, there's nothing else that we have to do. You know, things will kind of emerge, memories, emotions, physical energies get released, and then the experience culminates and then gets resolved, and people just end up in a very relaxed situation, and they go and draw what we call a mandala that we then use in small circles when we are sharing about the experience. And only if the breathing doesn't resolve something, then we have a certain kind of a body work where we help to release the remaining kind of residual emotions and physical energies and so on. But in many instances, people do the whole healing by themselves, guided by their own inner healing intelligence, rather through some kind of an interpretation that we would be giving them and so on.
Well, and you just touched on, you know, in the perfect scenario, people have this wonderful, easy inner healing experience. But I've had 20 years as somatic therapist, and I've seen so many people who have these places in their bodies or in their consciousness where they're stuck, and a healing modality can take them to that place with an invitation to unstick wherever they are. So you have really brought together the breathing, the mandala, the music, the body work, and all of it together to help people find those places where they're stuck and to work through that in a kind way.
Yeah, I would like to just respond to something that you said before. I don't think that I created the illusion that it's always easy. You know, the process is guided by inner intelligence, but if it's taking you to some really painful areas in your psyche, like if you are reliving births, for example, that lasted 40 hours where you almost died and forceps had to be used and so on, it's going to be challenging. It's not going to be, you know, very comfortable always or easy. But there is a generally sort of a positive quality to the process. The other important thing is you have to sort of create certain kind of situation for that, you know, like people taking LSD in raves is not a great way of using these kinds of tools. So we have to create the most supportive, the safest situation we can, and sort of give people support system, people, facilitators who have done a lot of inner work themselves and who can support them in whatever they have to experience. And then once you have that kind of a framework, that kind of a container, then you can really rely on the inner healing intelligence of the people in the group.
Right. Stan, your phone seems to be kind of fading in and out a little bit.
I have, I also hear you very, very low volume.
Okay.
Can you talk a little louder, too?
Sure.
Is that better now?
Yes, it is. Thank you. So, you know, you mentioned people taking LSD and going to a rave. I know you've had a lot of experience dating from the 1950s using hallucinogenic substances with a healing intention. Share with our audience just a little bit about how that helped you in your own healing journey.
Well, the first thing I would like to say is that, you know, I would have never ended up where I am without having volunteered as a beginning psychiatrist for an LSD session at the time when it was a very, very new and it was not really very well known what it does and where it's going to take us. And you know, I had very, very different ideas for my life, and I had such a powerful mystical experience in that first session that it created in me a kind of a lifetime passion for the research of these non-ordinary states.
Mm-hmm.
I came from a basically atheistic background. You know, there was a kind of a drama in our family when my parents met. They fell in love and wanted to get married in a small Czech city. The church refused to marry them because my father didn't have any church affiliation. He was a pagan by their definition. And my mother was from a very strictly Catholic family. And it was very, very difficult. It seemed like the wedding wouldn't happen at all until my grandparents found this brilliant solution, which, of course, was a major financial donation to the church. And they were able to release their, you know, rules and standards and marry a pagan. And my parents got so upset by this whole situation that they decided not to commit me or my brother to any religion, that we should sort of make up our own mind when we get when we come of age. And so I'm kind of somewhat a rare example of somebody who was brought to spirituality and mysticism through laboratory and clinical work. Usually it's the other way around. People come from a very religious background, and when they discover materialistic science, they tend to reject anything related to spirituality or religion as unscientific. So in this sense, it really, that even that session sent me in a completely different direction. And, you know, for me, the psychedelic experiences that I had always were very serious sort of steps on a spiritual journey. I've never sort of taken it lightly. It was never for kicks, you know. It was a kind of a serious spiritual, philosophical, and even scientific exploration for me. And it certainly has, you know, transformed me very, very profoundly.
The
first period when we worked with psychedelics, there was always this little of a suspicion, although we felt that it very likely is just a catalyst for the psyche. There was always the idea that maybe this is this exotic group of substances that in some way generate these experiences. And so when we developed the breathwork, when you can get the same spectrum of experiences with very simple means like faster breathing, music, bodywork, then it became absolutely clear that these are authentic experiences, that they are germane to the psyche, that we are dealing with the psyche per se. So if you take psychedelics, you don't have a psychedelic experience. You have an experience of yourself, of your own psyche, only from levels that are normally not available. So in that sense, the holotropic breathwork became very, very important for me.
So would you say that with the right intention, an LSD or hallucinogenic plant, the breath work, deep states of meditation, peak experiences with a spiritual teacher, do they all have access to this holotropic subgroup of consciousness?
Yes, I use that term, you know, although it's sort of tied with the breath work, we use it frequently, it's a holotropic breath work. But for me, that term holotropic experience covers a very wide spectrum. Exactly what you were talking about. The states of mystics of the different mystical traditions, the states that you can experience in near-death situations, for example. You know, the kind of experiences that the yogis have, that the Buddhists have, and so on. Also, for many people, this happens spontaneously in the middle of everyday life. They don't really do anything for it. They are not trying to induce these states. They might even be fighting them, and they would come anyway. So this is the category of these spontaneous episodes of holotropic states that Christina and I call spiritual emergencies. It would be a significant subgroup of what a current psychiatry calls psychotic experience. And we found out on the basis of the work with psychedelics and then the breathwork that you can actually work with these states the way you would work with states that are induced by some means. And you can take people through these states rather than just suppressing the experiences as they are emerging. Mm-hmm. And people can emerge, you know, and get a lot of healing out of it and transformation. Mm-hmm. And I believe there's even an evolutionary potential in these experiences.
Are there signals that let you know that somebody's having a spiritual emergency versus a psychotic break that actually requires hospitalization or medication of some kind?
Well, the first indication would be that the person would be having experiences that we see daily in working with groups of people who are not necessarily psychiatric patients, like a group that we will be working with in Houston. You know, you will see people going through death rebirth experiences, having past life experiences, having archetypal experiences, mystical experiences, and so on. So if those are experiences that normally take, like, for many people, you know, half an hour, 45 minutes of faster breathing, then it's very difficult for me to see them as some kind of exotic pathology, you know, yet to be identified by future research. It's clear for me that these are experiences that any human being can have under certain circumstances. So that's the first indication. The other thing we look at is whether the person is willing to do the inner work. Some people will tell you, you know, I've had enough of this suffering. Just give me something so I can sleep and, you know, don't feel this anxiety and so on. And that's fine as long as people know there is alternative, rather than presenting it to them as the scientific way of dealing with these states. There's also a certain kind of a communication style. You know, a person who would be in what we call spiritual emergency would sound like a normal person who just had 300 micrograms of LSD. I will be telling you sort of wild stories, but would be pretty articulate and together. For example, would be saying like, you know, the last 3 weeks I have been having these powerful surges of energy going up my spine. I am having visions of light. Sometimes I see some mythological images and so on. I see lights. Sometimes I have the feeling like I've been in another century, in another country and so on. So that's kind of strange experiences, but they would be describing it pretty normally. They would not be mixing it with everyday reality. Whereas an example of what we still would consider a psychotic experience would be somebody who would come to you and says, you know, I have this evil neighbor and he's sort of digging these tunnels into my cellar and he's getting inside of my house, getting into my fridge at night and poisoning my food, and he put these bugging devices all over my house. And you ask the person, you know, why is he doing it? And he says, well, you know, he's really on the payroll of the mafia. The mafia really cannot stand me because I'm such a moral person. And so he's getting paid for that, and the money for it is really coming from the Middle East. These are the petrodollars. I mean, you get a very different kind of a sense. Mm-hmm. For somebody who is experiencing episodes that are potentially healing or transformative, or at least that you can work with productively.
So what I hear you saying is one way to tell the difference is to be around people who are having holotropic experiences and to see how they communicate and they relate to their expanded awareness versus somebody who is really pathologically psychotic. And so you can really tell the difference in the way those people are communicating.
You know, also, if you have had experiences like this yourself, and if you have seen hundreds or thousands of people going through these experiences, you will develop a certain kind of an understanding. So when you sit down with that person, that person would have a sense that you know what they are talking about. Whereas if they are sitting with somebody with traditional training and the only thing they can tell them is that this is a disease that has to be controlled, this is not something that they feel internally. They feel frequently the positive potential of these experiences, the possibility of spiritual opening, the possibility of healing. So if you just invalidate that state, just put a pathological label on it, it cuts off any kind of meaningful communication with that person. But if you ask intelligent questions, like the person said, talked about a past life experience, and you say, well, could you tell, which century it was in? Could you tell which country? Were there any sort of synchronicities associated with it and so on? Sooner or later, the person knows that we are somehow on the same platform, that we are really meaningfully communicating. So you would have a much better chance of working with these people than somebody who just completely denies or puts down this whole area of what we now call transpersonal experiences.
So you're pointing to something interesting to me, Stan. So many people seek out peak experiences, whether it's with hallucinogenic drugs or through, running marathons or breath experiences or meditation retreats, and we touch that place of wholeness and healing, and we have, as you mentioned, past life experiences or visions or images or sensations that flush the body. So how can we ensure that, real healing happens? Is it setting an intention? Is it connecting with that inner intelligence in a significant way?
Well, there's something is important. There's a difference when these experiences happen to people in the right kind of context. Let's say if you are a Vipassana Buddhist meditator, you have meditated for years, you go to, maybe Jack Kornfield's lectures, you have done a lot of reading and so on, and then you have these experiences. They happen in a very appropriate context, and you know what to do with them, you can categorize them and so on. It's very different from a situation when this happened to somebody in the middle of everyday life, when their whole existence up to that point was just absolutely materialistically oriented. They had no interest in these areas. They might even have kind of a derogative attitude to this whole realm. So this is a really important thing, the set and setting within which these experiences happen. Then the other thing is, it's important, what culture it happens in. If you are living with the Wicho Indians, where all have experiences in rituals and so on, and you start having these experiences, if anything, it brings you closer to other people, makes you more of a member of a tribe. Whereas if it happens in our culture, where the basic orientation is either sort of monistic, materialistic, or sort of, let's say, fundamentalist Christian, and those experiences would not be in the context of your belief system, then it will create confusion. It will create a conflict.
Right.
This is something that happened in the 60s, where a lot of people started taking psychedelics, and they were opening realms that were not really acceptable to our mainstream culture.
Mm-hmm.
And they basically alienated themselves from mainstream to a great, great extent.
Mm-hmm. I know one of the practices that you use in your holotropic breath is the witness, the sitter, who is really present and watching the experience. How is the importance of a witness different than, say, some of my own medicine experiences were with Terence McKenna's philosophy of 5 grams of mushrooms in the dark alone with, you know, setting a ritual intention. So, you know, I was very much on my own having expanded experiences versus with somebody who's really watching and caring and holding the space for the process.
Well, you know, I think both, you can say something for both of those approaches, but to do it in a kind of a ritual way on your own, the way you're doing it, I think you should already know yourself well. You should have done some work with some, you know, with some guidance, so you know where these states take you. I wouldn't recommend it, you know, to general population, because you don't know where people are. You know, some people had extremely difficult life, difficult births, difficult childhood, difficult later life, and these experiences can take them to very, very difficult areas. And many people have a history of bad experiences with other people, you know, beginning with their mother, father, family, and so on, and then, you know, going maybe to schoolmates. And so they need desperately something that we call corrective experience, to go back there into that state of vulnerability and suddenly finding that the circumstances are completely different. There's a sympathetic, supportive person that is there. So that's extremely important. People are reliving, for example, episodes of abandonment. Somebody was born premature and spent the first 3 months in an incubator, no positive human contact at all. We actually go as far as to use physical contact, where people are deeply regressed, so that we can give on a very deep level the sense of being helpless but safe.
Mm-hmm.
So there's something to say for this approach, particularly if it's at the beginning of the journey, you know, where you really have to do a lot of individual healing from infancy, from childhood, and so on. Once you have enough experience, then you can move to some other ways. Although I have to tell you that I have had my share of psychedelic experiences with different substances, laboratory and natural. And if I had another psychedelic session, I would like somebody to be there with me,
mm-hmm.
because I have too much respect where this can take you under certain circumstances. And you might have 20 sessions where you can handle it comfortably, and then the 21st is going to bring something that you're really going to be happy that there's somebody with you. So this would be, you know, this would be my perspective on that. The other thing is the sharing groups are extremely important. You know, a lot of people carry some material that they feel is very objectionable, that they feel guilty about, and so on. And if I work with them individually, I sort of accept them with what they are telling me, I have seen very frequently that people see it as a result of my professional training. You know, the stuff they're talking about is bad, but I've been trained to listen to this stuff, very much like a surgeon can see blood, you know, that an average person would be freaked out by. Now, if we do the sharing, and then one after another, people share very intimate material, it becomes very liberating, that after a while there's a sense we are all in it together. You know, to be incarnate means to have problems of one kind or another, and we find out that other people have many of the problems that we have ourselves, or that we're blaming ourselves for, and so on. So one part of it is to have the assistant in the session itself, but the other one to also have the group sharing, which gives you tremendous permission, in a sense, to be who you are and still be accepted, you know, by other people.
Mm-hmm. There is so much going on in the world that we live in today with the environment and the energy crisis and war and terror and poverty and human cruelty. And it's easy to get distracted by, you know, what are these crises that are going on? And I feel that the real crisis is the lack of human development and human growth in the world population. And what I think you offer with your books and your teaching and your training is a tool that we can all use to all grow as human beings and to really begin to tackle these problems in a much more effective and conscious way.
I think the work with holotropic states, on the one hand, gives you deeper insights, you know, into very destructive forces such as human violence or human greed, forces which have been running human history, you know, since the beginning.
Since we crawled out of the caves.
It gives you a tool how you can process, how you can work on some of these very dangerous elements in human nature, so that a lot of that stuff happens on the mattress, you know, with human support, rather than somewhere in a situation where there's war happening or revolution and so on. You know, people can express anger in a way that's very constructive and very, very healing and very transformative. But if they are given sort of context and opportunities to act it out, it's very likely that they will.
Right. To express anger in a mature way as opposed to a destructive way.
Yeah, the important thing is that acting out anger and frustration and so on does not really resolve it. It gives you a momentary relief, but it doesn't go deep enough to transform you in any way. You have to really go deep into your unconscious to be able to reach where these kinds of forces reside in human nature.
I have a personal question for you, Stan. What regular or daily spiritual practices do you use in your life right now?
Well, I have been really very, very eclectic. You know, I have tried many, many different things. A lot of my practice was within Siddha Yoga, when we were with Swami Muktananda. Quite a bit of it was Vipassana, was Jack. You know, some Zen. I see my experiences with psychedelics and the breath work and so on being, you know, part of the spiritual journey. But I wouldn't say that I have sort of one practice that I stick with.
Mm-hmm.
I think it has something to do also with the fact that curiosity is a very important part of my nature. So I have always wanted to experience sort of different roads.
Curiosity as a spiritual practice.
Well, curiosity, you know, what the different spiritual systems have to offer, and how they are finding their way to the transcendent and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So
how did
you ask me? You know, I probably am in the system that I feel most comfortable with lies somewhere between Buddhism and Hinduism. Mm-hmm. That I like the simplicity of the Buddhist approach, but I also love the richness of the Hindu mythology and so on. As far as Christianity is concerned, I would have to go back to people like Brother David Steindl-Rass or Father Bede Griffith, you know, people who belong to the Benedictine order, who are really trying to go back to what Christianity was supposed to be as compared to what it has become. And then once you have connection with that original message, you find out that it's not that different from some of the other spiritual messages.
Right, right.
We spent a lot of time with Brother David Steinor asked when we were at Esalen, because the Hermitage of Immaculate Heart is about 10 miles down the coast, and Brother David came frequently to our workshops, giving talks and so on. And it was quite remarkable. You know, there were many people in our groups who came up from Christian backgrounds and got to the point that they really got alienated from their own tradition and very critical. And Brother David was able, in a couple of hours, really show them, you know, what the original message was and where things went wrong. I basically like all mystical traditions, you know, because I find out that the mystics of all religions, they basically saying the same thing, and I think they also would get along very, very well with each other, whereas the organized religions, you know, frequently have a tendency to be in war with each other because of their differences. Or you have even a situation where one religion, you know, different aspects, different factions of the same religion get into war, where the differences are enough to kill each other. Like the histories of the fights between the Protestants and the Catholics, or the split within Islam, and so on.
So a person comes to spend the weekend with you doing a holotropic breath experience, and the inner wisdom that we all have guides us to that place we most need healing. And so many people report having extraordinary experiences in the holotropic breath seminars. How can we then integrate that into our lives to get the most effectiveness from the weekend?
Well, when you know, when we work with people using these holotropic states, we usually try to do it in a context that would make that possible, to bridge that gap between the holotropic and the what I call the hyalotropic. Hyale means matter, so the matter-oriented consciousness is compared to the consciousness oriented toward toward wholeness. So, for example, when we were doing the psychedelic sessions, you know, we would, once the person worked through some of the major issues that they had, we would bring in family members, we would listen to music, we would bring in some wonderful food from a carry-out place, we would go and watch the sunset or smell the hay and so on, so that all these new feelings are attached to aspects of ordinary life. You can learn how to see the world in a different way, how to taste food in a different way, how to listen to music in a different way, how to make love in a different way, and so on. So the same, you know, ideally in the holotropic breathwork, we would do it in a place where people are coming down, would be exposed to the best of nature. You know, there would be mountains around, or forests, or meadows, or a lake, or the ocean, and so on. So that you help to attach these new feelings to everyday situations, so that people don't end up with a situation where this is the low level here, the material world, and the body is the kind of a low-level category of reality, and the holotropic world is kind of glorious. You want to ultimately bring them together. You want to create a synthesis that the experiences that you had sort of enhance your everyday life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, then that kind of search becomes very valuable, of course.
I find in my own work that sensation is an important part of anchoring these higher states of consciousness into the body and into my everyday life. So as you mentioned, smelling hay or going to a sunset, or, you know, what's the sensation of that higher state and how does it feel in my physical body?
Yeah, you see, we are living in a culture, the modern civilization, the industrial civilization. But one extremely important characteristic is alienation. Whenever you read about modern humanity, you always find the term. We are alienated from each other. We are alienated from our bodies. We are alienated from nature. We are alienated from the cosmos. We have lost meaningful spirituality, experiential spirituality, and so on. So systematic and responsible work with these holotropic states can really lift that feeling of alienation and
mm-hmm.
brings you in much closer with other people and with nature and with the you know glory of the cosmos. And this
mm-hmm.
happens very, very, very typically to people. There are people who have experiences of this kind and then start seeing the world in a very different way. They say, well, I've never really noticed that the sun was setting, or I've never really paid attention to flowers in spring. I was too busy doing, you know, my thing. I was getting to my job and, you know, making money, and I really never paid much attention to how much opportunity to have positive experiences are actually in everyday life. That doesn't cost anything. It's just a question of being able to look and experience in the right way. So you can get a lot of richness, which has nothing to do with possessions or money, which has to do with your ability to perceive the world in a certain way.
Well, I've got a few more questions for you, Stan, but before I ask those, I just want to share with the people on the call about the workshop coming up in Houston. It starts on Friday night, June the 6th. There is a public program that's open to anybody, and you'll be talking about the healing potential of these non-ordinary states of consciousness. And then after that public talk, the workshop will begin for those that are staying on through the weekend. It'll last all day on Saturday and through noon on Sunday, June the 8th. So if you're at all intrigued and want to experience the holotropic breathwork with Stan, and I invite you to really consider joining us. Stan is one of the great pioneers of consciousness. In the last 100 years, it's a real privilege to have him in Houston and to be able to study and work with him and share his wisdom. So for more information about the workshop, you can email workshop@holotropic.com. That's holotropic.com. Or you can call 415-383-8779 and get more information about the workshop coming up in Houston. So just a couple more things for you, Dan. Somebody was concerned about the intensity of the breathing and the rapid breathing and the possibility of hyperventilation. They wanted to make sure that it was safe for them to breathe in this way.
You see, what I would like to say, this is not any kind of extreme work with breath work. Like people have heard sometimes about pranayama, where you actually very forcefully breathe through the nostrils or alternate with the nostrils and so on. Here it's not that much, excessive breathing as it is the quality that you pay to your breathing, to your breath.
Mm-hmm.
It's just somewhat faster, somewhat deeper than usual, tying the exhalation and the inhalation into kind of a circle of breath, but keeping in touch with the breath. So this is why the workshops with Jack are so great, because he's teaching people the Vipassana awareness, Vipassana Buddhist awareness that is used in the insight meditation. And this is also the ideal attitude that you would have to your breathing when you do a holotropic breathwork workshop.
Mm.
So, you know, people are breathing already, and you can breathe a little faster, you can breathe, you know, more. You're basically in charge, you're in control. Breathing is something mm-hmm. that is an automatic function, but you can also always override it. You can slow it down, you can make it faster. So that experience is very, very different from taking a psychedelic substance where once you swallow it, you have no more control over what's going to happen. Here you have to work.
Yes, see, in 8 hours.
Yeah, you have to work here to get deeper into your psyche.
Well, and you made the point, we're breathing already, but for most of us, how conscious is that breathing? And for this window of time, you really pay attention to the breath and the quality of breath and the sensation of the breath.
You know, how many people breathe with the eyes closed? If you close your eyes, you already cut off all the external input that would distract you and helps you tremendously to pay attention to your body and to your breathing. So even just the fact that it's done with the eyes closed helps tremendously to use this potential of the breath to take you inside.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that, you know, to access the holotropic quality of consciousness, you know, it might be 45 minutes of breathing. Say somebody's in their life and they find themselves in some stressful state, can you recommend a very quick practice that would just help them shift out of, say, anxiety or fear or stress and have access to a calmer state of being?
Well, I definitely would not. You know, we actually talked about this already when we discussed sitters and so on. Again, you would not want to give it as a general advice. It's okay for everybody to do this because, you know, people are in different places and somebody can be sitting on a lot of difficult material, and it's very easy to open it up, but then you really want to have somebody who knows how to work with that situation. Now, if you have had, you know, sufficient experience with these states, that is a different story. Then you can sort of experiment on your own. But it's certainly not something that I would recommend for people who have never done this before. Really start,
okay,
you know, in a situation where you get very good support.
So my last question for you, Stan. What would you say has contributed most to your ability to love in your life?
Well, I think those were experiences where I felt loved. You know, mostly what I'm talking about is the experiences where I had the feeling of being in touch with the cosmic creative source and experiences the enormous love that was kind of pouring out of that. So I believe that was the most, that was the most significant factor in my life. And of course,
all right. Well, Stan, thank you very much.
You know, I was very, very lucky to have really wonderful parents and a wonderful brother. So I also got it on another level, just not just everything from the cosmic dimension. You know, this is also one situation where you learn to love if you get enough love from your environment when you're growing up.
Well, and you've had the great fortune to share your work and your life with your wife, who's helped you with this journey so much.
Thank you again. Thank you. This was really wonderful to talk to you.
Well, thank you very much. It's a privilege to be with you. Thanks, everybody, for listening through the call, and we sure hope to see you in Houston in June. So thanks and good night.
Good night. Are you still there?
The moderator has disconnected. The call will now end. Welcome to the conferencing service. Please enter your conference ID followed by the pound sign. Thank you. Please hold while we validate your Thank you. Please hold while we validate your conference ID. Conference ID accepted. The moderator has not yet arrived. Please wait. Welcome to the conferencing service. Please enter your conference ID followed by the pound sign. Thank you. Thank you. Please hold while we validate your conference ID. Conference ID accepted. The moderator has not yet arrived. Please wait. Welcome to the conferencing service. Please enter your conference ID followed by the pound sign. Thank you. Please hold while we validate your conference ID. Conference ID accepted. The moderator has not yet arrived. Please wait. Thank you. Please hold while we validate your conference ID. Conference ID accepted. The moderator has not yet arrived. Please wait.